Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Mr. Khos at 7 o'clock. We're doing things differently as we have been. We're starting the new year off on a new footing and we're trying out some new things, right? So this week we are trying out some new celebrity middle names. Middle names you would not expect to find a celebrity having. Today's one is a German middle name. I'll give you the celebrity's first and last name, Leonardo DiCaprio. Any guesses as to what the middle name is? It's a German middle name. It is Wilhelm. Leonardo Wilhelm DiCaprio. What a weird name. You're tuned into the SFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Moyaha. And on the show today, we are taking a look at the latest rumors that Mazda Southern Africa is leaving the country. We speak to the managing director at Mazda Southern Africa, Craig Roberts, around the rumors, find out if they're true and where they originated from, if we can. Then we've got a conversation around the national minimum wage. It seems national minimum wage is set to increase, but alongside that increase, there's also an increase in non-compliance. Employers are not paying national minimum wage. We'll look at the reasons behind that and try and understand what's happening there. Then we've got a conversation with Alan Gray's Rory Kutiska-Jacobson around their outlook for 2025, following 2024 being one of the busiest election years that was. And then we wrap the show up with a executive lounge segment. We speak to the outgoing or retiring CEO at Astral Foods, Chris Skitter, around his 20 plus years at Astral Foods, 16 of which were spent as the CEO, but 40 years in the poultry space in general. You want to stick around for that conversation. It's coming up later in the show.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As we always do, we kick off the show with a sense of how the markets have been moving throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by Sasfin Wealth's David Shapiro to take a look at the market movements and see what they mean. Good evening, Uncle David. Happy New Year to you. Lovely to catch up with you. Today, we were pleasantly surprised by US data. I want to start there because for the last 2 weeks and for the longest time, markets have been on edge. Everything's been uncertain. There's been a lot of confusion. There's been a lot of panic. But today, US data came out. US CPI came out surprising to the downside. And equity markets absolutely loved that, especially ours.
Well, you know, they've been so nervous about inflation and what it means. And I don't think the Fed governor, you know, Jay Powell, has given any kind of understanding or direction to the market, and therefore the confusion or uncertainty has caused the kind of moves that we saw. And immediately these numbers came out, the view that rates would go down sometimes like September, October, that's far into the year. They've reduced it now, say, okay, we'll get again probably by halfway through the year. But if this trend continues, which a number of people have actually alluded to, you know, believing that inflation will come down, then we might get more of the same. But it just shows you how the mindset changed so dramatically, you know, so fast. And just looking at the U.S. markets, you know, the Nasdaq is now up over 2%, S&P well over 1%. So there've been big gains there. And if you look at the raw numbers, It's just a move in the right direction. You know, they're not dramatic falls in inflation. It's just that the market was geared for a lot worse.
When we look at these moves and we look at the responses that markets are giving, does it look like this is going to be sustained? I mean, I look at the moves that we got last week and the moves that we got when we got other U.S. announcements that weren't so positive. I mean, I think back to the December rate decision that first gave us an indication that we would be seeing less rate cuts into 2025. That sent the markets into a tailspin, and it's been kind of trying to recover since effectively that announcement. Is this kind of recovery something that could potentially be short-lived? Or
we've still got Mr. Trump. You know, and that's the missing factor.
Who's going to be inaugurated next week.
You know, that's exactly why. So at the moment, on the numbers that are coming out now, it's looking good. You know, it looks like this is going to continue to improve. But we don't know what's going to happen with tariffs. But, you know, even yesterday, the announcement came that his advisors are saying, just take it cooler. Let's, you know, we'll approach it in a much more organized way. So I think the fear is that, you know, by increasing taxes without thinking about it, you're really going to throw the global economy into a speed wobble, you know, into a real wobble, and probably change the axis of the Earth's spin. So, there are deep concerns about that, particularly in China. And I don't think there's any benefit out of that. You know, it doesn't pay to weaken the rest of the world, no matter what your policies are, because eventually it reflects, it will come back to you. You know, even though the U.S. economy is a standalone economy, you know, there's a lot of internal sales. It's got its own internal markets, but still, they're not separate, completely separate from what's happening in the rest of the world. So, I think that hopefully there's some adults in his, in his cabinet, you know, who can actually say to him, look, Mr. Donald, you know, understand what the kind of damage that you will do to other economies, not going to help us.
So definitely not taking into or not having the markets operate in isolation. It's all good and well to have the U.S. economy say that they are stronger, obviously benefiting greatly. And we're starting to see those benefits of that stimulus package that came out in the pandemic. I think we forgot about that package for the longest time. And now we're starting to see the fruits of that, where inflation isn't behaving the way we thought it might. The U.S. economy is holding stronger for longer. But it was a significant stimulus package.
It was, and yes, the benefits are still there, but it's also a very vibrant economy. We can't ignore what's happening at the top end of the market. Can't ignore the developments that are happening in AI, the continuation of money that's going in, the richness of the top end of the S&P, the Mag 7 plus. Well, you can add a few extra as well. And that's what's driving the, that's really what's driving the U.S. But they're not in isolation. You know, they can't operate really in isolation. And I think that's where all these other worries came in. You know, what's the benefit of tariff increases? You know, what's the whole understanding? What do you want to achieve at the end of the day? You know, and I think a lot of people confused about what the ultimate aim of Trump is. You know, make America great again. What does that mean? You know, make everybody else weak again. Well, so okay. So I'm just hoping that he sobers up a little, or certainly his cabinet sober up and say, okay, look, we're strong enough. We don't really need tax reductions. You know, we don't need these things. We can, if we just carry on along the same trajectory now, we're going to be fine.
And where, as that sense prevails, we start to see it in the other markets as well. I mean, I'm looking at the Rand as well. 19 Rand 20 is where we started the week, not off the back of Rand weakness of any kind. Now we're back at 18 Rand 78, showing that markets, when they do start to stabilize and sense does start to prevail, that things go back to normal.
Exactly. And that can happen fast. You know, you spoke about 1920. We're now in the 1870s. If you, Jimmy, you've got to look at the U.S. bond market, because there were some big falls in yields on the 10-year, down 13.5 pips. You know, so we were worried that the 10-year was heading towards 5, which was kind of a break point, you know, a nervy point. And it's now at 4.65 heading down. So that's the impact that's had. And also the fears were at the 30-year bond, you know, which is the that's the level that people set their mortgage rates from. You know, there was also worries about where that would go. That's down to 4.88. So there's been big reversals in U.S. bonds, and of course that's put pressure on the dollar. So we could, if this continues, let's say for after Trump, he's not so aggressive on that. Yes, we can see a massive improvement in the Rand, as we saw towards the end of last year. So that's what we have to watch. It's got nothing to do with South Africa. It's got nothing to do with us. That's where it is, you know. It's all going to be dollar.
Speaking of things that have to do with South Africa, I looked at the local performers. Financial stocks finally coming back off the back of those softer inflation numbers in the U.S. Late session today, the all share, or the top 40 gaining about 1.8% for the day, but around 1.2% of that coming through in that hour when we got that inflation print. What are you looking at for this year, Uncle David, in terms of stocks that could potentially look good for you, sectors that could look good? Why are you approaching those specific sectors, looking into what we could be in for?
It's hard to read South Africa. I don't think it's as easy. There's some very good operational businesses, smaller businesses. I was just looking through Karooooo's numbers now, and they're producing fantastic results. And I think that's still happening in South Africa. It's not happening in Singapore. So when you start to unpack some of the smaller businesses, there are companies that are holding their own. Our big fear, Jimmy, is the resource market. We've got to see stabilization in resource prices and the rand steady, costs come down and production start to pick up. That's where we're going to make the big money. Iron ore prices are still below 100. So, below 100, we need China also to stabilize, for them to steady their economy. And I think that's where the gains are going to come from. So you've got to be very hopeful on what happens in China. From our point of view, I was just, the repo rate, if I'm not mistaken, is still around about 7.75%. That's high. That means that your overdraft rates are still over 11%. Your prime rate, you might be able to negotiate something lower than that. But, at 11.25%, it's very difficult for SA Incorporated, for businesses to operate when they're still borrowing money at those levels. So it's essential that, inflation is heading in the right direction, but it's essential that the Reserve Bank also start to recognize, hold on, we need rates to come down dramatically. And I know they stick to their policies, but somewhere along the line, we need something to give in that direction. To help the consumer, to help banks, to help businesses.
So then, Uncle David, before I let you go, what's the rate cut call for the 30th of January? That's the first meeting we've got.
We might have one. Yeah, we might get a 0.25%. But you know what? After that, nix. That's the problem.
That's the problem.
We might get the one now, which is a catch-up for the US's December rate cut. So we might get it. But, if you look at the forward markets after that, there's not much hope of much more happening on that. That's scary. So we need that. We need someone to come and give us a bit of love, consumers and that, just to put more money in your back pocket so that we can get this economy going. So there are quite a few factors out there. That's why, going on, when we talk about American exceptionalism, that economy is so strong, but Europe, Europe, the UK, South Africa, so many others, Canada, you name it, all under pressure. Even when I was in Australia, everybody was moaning and groaning there, all about the same factors. So we're not alone.
What makes the South Africa picture different? Because obviously I was looking at some of the interesting stats saying that from a bond perspective, our bond yields are sitting at some of the most attractive, and our inflation has come below 3%. We've got inflation levels that are bordering on what the US has got at the moment. So there's no way that South Africa's not fighting inflation.
Yeah, so we are. So if you look at those bond rates and you look at your inflation, right, there's a massive real return. which is the other aspect of it. So there is the capacity to actually bring down rates. There is that. Anyway, but listen, I'm not the monetary theorist on that. I'm just a grumpy investor.
Well, the monetary policies will be decided soon, and as will the budget speech that we'll get at some point, and I'm sure you and I will catch up around both of those events. For now, Uncle David, thank you so much for the time. As always, David Shapiro of Sasfin Wealth on the market movements throughout the day and the sense of optimism that seems to be slowly creeping in.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
With the benefit of hindsight, investors would undoubtedly do better. But the reality is that the future is always uncertain and risks always abound. That said, the past holds some important lessons. Tune into the SAFM Market Update this evening at 6:45 as Rory Kutiska-Jacobson, Portfolio Manager at Allan Gray, joins us to explore how 2024, the great election year, has shaped the opportunity set for long-term investors. brought to you by Alan Gray. More than 50 years of long-term investment. Alan Gray is an authorized financial services provider.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Now, there have been rumors around, circulating around the rumor mill that Mazda Southern Africa, after 55 years of operating in South Africa, is just going to close down. They're just going to up and leave. They will no longer be part of the South African automobile sector, and we can say goodbye to them. I'm joined on the line by Craig Roberts, Managing Director at Mazda Southern Africa, to address these rumors and see whether or not they're true. Good evening, Craig. Thanks so much for taking the time. Are you leaving?
Absolutely not. And good evening, Jimmy, and good evening to the listeners. I can categorically state that we definitely are not exiting South Africa.
There we go. End of conversation. They're not going anywhere. So then why were the rumors circulating? What happened that sort of stoked the fires and had everybody concerned?
Yeah, I think, you know, Jimmy, there's possibly a number of reasons why the, I suppose, narrative evolved. Obviously, you know, from a Mazda perspective, you know, we've seen a shift in where we position our vehicles into the South African market. And, you know, Mazda has moved not only in the South African market, but globally, or in the process of transitioning into, you know, different segments. For example, sakes, we are moving into medium to larger SUVs, and also with a huge focus on what we refer to as new energy vehicles with alternate powertrains. Here we're talking PHEV, battery electric vehicles, etc. And I think that, you know, with the fact that we have seen, you know, the actual volume of sales decrease because of that repositioning, there potentially were rumors and rumblings, etc., that were put out into the public space. And we as Mazda South Africa felt that it was, you know, it was time for us to actually address those, and also to, you know, reassure our many Mazda owners, customers, that it was, you know, and we can categorically state that we are not exiting South Africa. In fact, you know, we're really excited about, you know, some of the new product developments that, you know, are in markets, in various Mazda markets, but also, you know, we are looking at bringing those to the South African market.
Mm. Craig, while I have you, can we discuss some of those exciting things that are coming up? I mean, we've seen a lot of companies increase their efforts to invest in South Africa, their plans to invest. We've seen a lot of conversations around just energy transitions. We've got new EV legislation. What are Mazda's plans for the Southern African market?
From a product perspective, Jimmy, you know, the biggest one that we're really excited about is the all-new CX-5. CX-5 is probably our biggest volume seller over the last 10 years since Mazda re-entered as an independent automotive entity in the South African market. And that new CX-5 will debut in the third quarter of this year and will probably hit our shores in the first quarter of 2026. And that is the first product that we're really, really excited about, is that all-new CX-5. Also, basically, we are looking at some of those larger platform SUVs that Mazda has successfully introduced into its global markets. And here I'm referring to the CX-60 PHEV, and also the possibility of bringing a CX-80, which is a 7-seater PHEV, to the South African market. Those two vehicles, being PHEVs and also a 7-seater, will be firsts for Mazda in South Africa.
So not only is Mazda not leaving, you're in fact expanding your product range and introducing new products into the market. That's quite interesting. Craig, I want to take a look at, obviously, with everything that's happening, there are still some concerns that might sit in the automotive space. There's some logistical concerns that companies like Mazda have had to contend with for a couple of years. How are you seeing the automotive landscape at the moment? How are you seeing just where the demand is sitting, not just in South Africa, but in the other Southern African countries that you guys service?
Jimmy, it's a very interesting question, and I think, you know, we could probably spend a number of hours, you know, discussing it. But I think if I had to encapsulate it, yes, we've all faced, and here I refer to, you know, our competitor brands and our colleagues in the industry, we've faced many challenges when it comes to, you know, logistics and supply, not necessarily just in the past few months, but over the past few years. I think that, you know, we really need to see an improvement in those, but it's also incumbent on us being able to service our customers and to find ways around those challenges, which, you know, we as NASDA have done, looking to basically ensure that, you know, we are able to provide the level of experience that is expected from a brand like NASDA. With regards to, you know, the South African auto market, it certainly is a dynamic one, if I can use that term. We basically have a market that has over 40 passenger car brands in market, which is, if not the highest, one of the highest numbers of passenger car brands available to consumers when choosing a vehicle to purchase. That, I think, is fantastic. I think that, you know, every consumer should have freedom of choice and as much choice as possible. It's in then, you know, up to brands like Mazda to ensure that, you know, we do everything we need to do to gain the share of that market that we possibly can.
Craig, with all of the geopolitical tensions happening around the world, with all of the uncertainty that persists around various regions, are you guys looking at perhaps expanding into other regions on the African continent, perhaps rolling out some new products in other areas where you might not have previously had as big a presence?
It certainly would be an agenda item, you know, with Mazda at head office in Hiroshima. I have had discussions with head office in Hiroshima about, you know, various other African markets. Mazda does have representation in certain West African, Sub-Saharan and East African markets with, you know, product lineups in those markets. And, you know, I have no doubt that this would definitely be something that is on the minds and on the horizon and on the radar of Mazda senior executives.
There you have it, folks. Mazda Southern Africa is going nowhere. In fact, they're bringing new things for you to try out. So all the rumors that are going around are completely false, and you've heard it straight from the team at Mazda. Thanks so much, Craig, for those insights. Craig Roberts, Managing Director at Mazda Southern Africa, on their business sticking around for potentially another 55 years.
When you're growing your money, you need to make the right choices. That's why at Standard Bank Private, we offer the best of everything. Our offshore investments are award-winning. We'll give you the best forex rates around. As SA's biggest home loan provider, we offer unmatched expertise, and you'll have access to the best financial planners and bankers. So why not visit standardbank.co.za to join Africa's best private bank today? Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply. You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Anytime we bring up the minimum wage conversation, it becomes a very strange conversation because on one side of it, we are looking to increase the minimum wage. On the other side of it, companies are looking to spend less. But it seems as though as we're increasing the minimum wage, some companies are electing not to comply with that. I'm joined on the line by Senior Researcher for Development or for the Development and Policy Research Unit at UCT, Benjamin Stanwix, to take a look at this and understand it. Good evening, Benjamin. Thanks so much for taking the time. Why does non-compliance with minimum wage persist? Isn't it a law?
Hi, Jimmy. Thanks for having me. Yes, you're correct. It is a law. It's probably just worth giving some background on the work we've done for the National Minimum Wage Commission that oversees the minimum wage. So basically to figure out how to set the minimum wage, obviously there's a whole range of considerations, and specifically our work focused on last year's minimum wage and how it impacted on workers' earnings, their working hours and employment. And part of that consideration in looking at what happens to wages is whether they respond and how they respond to a changing minimum wage law. So these are quite basic issues, you might think, but having some idea of what happened last year is obviously really useful to policymakers when thinking about what to do next. It's not the only consideration, but it's one aspect that's really important to consider. So to your question about non-compliance, so we find that a relatively large share of workers still earn below the national minimum wage. It's worth pointing out, though, that this isn't, though that share has risen over the last couple of years, and we can talk about some reasons for that. It's not a new It's not a new observation. So, you know, for however long South Africa has had minimum wages since the early 2000s, there have been relatively high rates of non-compliance. There are many different explanations for why that is. I think a big reason is because of the high levels of unemployment in South Africa. It's, you know, it's a situation that leads a lot of workers to have very, very little bargaining power. And at the same time, the capabilities of the state to both inspect and enforce the level at which the minimum wage is set is relatively limited.
Mm. Some of the other factors, Benjamin, that have weighed in on this, I mean, we've seen companies reducing the hours that they then employ individuals for because minimum wage is increasing. But at the same time, as you mentioned, or as you alluded to, there are things around potentially cheaper labor being available out there. How do we navigate that part of the conversation? How do we look at national minimum wage, make sure it's enforced, but at the same time protect jobs and protect industries? We have employers that need to pay this wage, but we also have people that need to live off more than minimum wage.
Yeah, that's a difficult question, and I think that's the question that policymakers and the Minimum Wage Commission grapple with. So, I mean, if we step back and think about the minimum wage and the issue of non-compliance. So the current situation, as you point out, is that essentially minimum wage effects have been muted in South Africa. So when the minimum wage rises, the effects of that change are muted because some employers don't appear to respond to them. And as a result, we have many workers still earning below the minimum wage. So one option would be to, you know, keep a relatively high minimum wage and direct more resources towards enforcement to improve compliance. And really try to make sure that the minimum wage is taken seriously as a policy. At this point, we don't really know much about the implications of that because there's still such a large number of workers, you know, several million workers who are earning below the minimum wage and would require really, really large increases to get them up to that level. Another option would be to, you know, keep the minimum wage lower in, say, in relative terms to average earnings in South Africa, and ensure that it sets a kind of actual wage floor that hardly anyone earns below, and then use other kinds of mechanisms to try and ensure fair wages for workers above that floor. So that could be done, you know, regionally by kind of skill type or sector in other bargaining forums, or try and use some kind of wage subsidy mechanism to deal with workers who, you know, to try and ensure that workers can earn above the minimum wage where that's necessary. The alternative is what we have at the moment, which is kind of a minimum wage that's set relatively high to the median or average wage in South Africa, if you compare to other countries around the world, but it's not very well enforced according to the evidence that we have. So it becomes a kind of informal policy to some extent because it's adhered to by some employers and not others. And that may or may not be intentional from a policy point of view, but it results in a minimum wage policy that's in some sense aspirational for a large share of workers.
Benjamin, based on the studies that you guys have done and the report that you've compiled, does increasing the minimum wage result in a significant increase in job losses? Are we saying that the higher we set the minimum wage, the fewer jobs there will be? Because at the end of the day, we still are battling an unemployment crisis, but surely increasing the minimum wage can't have a negative impact.
Yeah, so we don't really find strong evidence of large job losses resulting from minimum wage increases. So the work we did looking at what happened in 2024 finds that increasing the minimum wage does lead to a large jump in wages for many workers. And in this case, for the previous year, we found some small reductions in working hours that you mentioned earlier. We find some evidence of a small reduction in employment, but it's a result that isn't really as clear in our work as the other two changes on wages and hours. So it's definitely not the case that we're seeing, you know, this policy resulting in really significant job losses. And part of the reason for that is because, potentially because a lot of employers are not paying the minimum wage. So it's not kind of moving through into effects on unemployment or anything else.
Mm. Benjamin, when you look at the work that the Commission has done and the report that you've compiled and put together, from a recommendation perspective, what were some of the recommendations you put forward around addressing the non-compliance aspects of it and ensuring that we kind of strike that balance to say it has to be enforced and we have identified ways to enforce it, but at the same time, we want to be looking out for employers, employees, and everybody in the value chain?
Yeah, I mean, so it's the job of the Commission to set the level and figure that out. And I think an interesting example perhaps is to think of how some other countries have done this. And one country that's similar to South Africa in many ways is Costa Rica. So they introduced a national minimum wage about 15 years ago in a similar manner to South Africa, where they had a complicated sectoral system, and then they grouped everything together and made a single national minimum wage. And they ran a really big public campaign to try and improve compliance at the same time as they introduced the minimum wage, to kind of create a level of consciousness among both employers and workers around the national minimum wage. So they had, you know, big adverts on television and online, billboards, posters. They had soccer players in national tournaments wearing T-shirts, advertising it and so on. And they encouraged workers to report violations, so they have a free hotline you can call. And at the same time, they directed more resources towards enforcement. So, I mean, some of those are relatively inexpensive, quite simple solutions to just at least make sure that both workers and employers know what the law is. And we're not sure to what extent a lack of knowledge drives some of the level of non-compliance in South Africa. But at least in the Costa Rican case, the combination of these efforts did actually work, and compliance with the new national minimum wage increased pretty significantly. So there are some kind of steps that one could take like that I think would be worth considering.
Minimum wage, still the hot topic, and still non-compliance persists. Hopefully these things change and people are paid a fair, livable wage. We'll leave the conversation there, Benjamin. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Benjamin Stanwyck, a senior researcher for development policy at UCT, who was part of this commission and this report that was put together around the minimum wage, joining us to take a look at why the non-compliance exists.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This segment is brought to you by Alan Gray. More than 50 years of long-term investing, Alan Gray is an authorized financial services provider. 2024 certainly was that great election year. More than 50% of the world's GDP went to the polls, and we saw lots of changes in the way of leadership changes. Certain political parties coming back, some political parties having surprise candidates. And all in all, through all of that, markets somehow managed to hold their ground and hold steady. But what does 2025 look like? What does 2025 hold for investors? I'm joined on the line by portfolio manager at Alan Gray, Rory Kutiska-Jacobs, to take a look at this and see if we can make sense of it. Good evening, Rory. Lovely to catch up with you, especially this early in the new year. Last year was quite an interesting year, with markets outperforming in certain respects and not outperforming if you compare them to other markets. I mean, the JSE did about 13% in terms of the all share, but that was considered underperformance by comparative standards when you look at some of the global peers. How did you reflect on the 2024 year that was?
Good evening, Jimmy. I mean, that's a great question. I think what really stood out for me was, I guess, two things from a market perspective. The first one is how the US just continues to massively outperform almost all other markets. So that's been pretty much the story of the last 5 years, where the US consistently outperforms. And if you look at last year, it was no different. The S&P, I think, was up just under 25% in dollars and about 29% in rands. And even within that, if you look at the technology bucket, I mean, the Mag 7 did incredibly well. And then the other thing that really stood out for me, I mean, you highlighted overall South Africa did around 13%. But what was interesting is there was quite a divergence in individual returns. So if you looked at kind of the traditional SA Inc. businesses, so the businesses very much focused on the South African economy, and you rewind the clock to kind of the start of 2024, huge uncertainty around the election. I think people were quite, and we were still experiencing quite significant levels of load shedding at the start of 2024. I think with the benefit of hindsight, people were probably overly pessimistic on SA. We had the election, we had the formation of the GNU, and we've seen a rapid improvement in sentiment, and you saw it in a number of the names. So overall, the JSE did around 13%. But if you look at individual kind of sectors, I mean, the domestic clothing sector, you had companies like Truers up 40-odd%. I think Pepco and Fashini both up north of 50%. And Mr. Price was up almost 100%, including dividends. And then the banks were all did kind of very healthy double-digit returns. And you saw Nedbank up 40-odd%, Capitec up 50-odd%. And you can go through the list. I mean, if you look at some of the food producers, so AVI and Tiger Brands both had gains north of 40%. Premier, which I listed not too recently ago, that was up over 100%. Premier, funny enough, struggled to list at the time when they listed. And now suddenly with an improvement in sentiment, it's amazing how quickly these things change.
Mm-hmm. Rory, some of the stocks were not so fortunate. I mean, you mentioned some of the really good winners and some of the really good standout businesses, but I also think about some of the guys that had a torrid time. I mean, the likes of Sasol experiencing probably one of their worst years in recent memory, and that's just one example. How do you reflect on some of the underperformers and perhaps some of the factors that led to that?
So I guess I've given you the one half of the story, and then if you say, well, how do you square that with 13% overall? It's because, by and large, the mining companies massively underperformed. And so you've highlighted Sasol, but, I mean, the likes of Glencore, BHP, Anglo American all did relatively poorly in rands. Most of the platinum group metal businesses were down 20, 30% in rands. And a lot of that is driven by what's happened in China and are related to kind of commodity demand. So if you think over the last 15, 20 years, China's economy has very much been driven by an infrastructure-led investment growth, and they're struggling to transition to consumer-led growth. And that slowdown on the infrastructure side has had a knock-on impact on commodity prices, which then reflects in the performance of the mining stocks. And then the other bucket that I think did relatively poorly from a JSE perspective were the multinationals that happened to be listed on the JSE, but by and large are global businesses. So the likes of Mondi had a very poor year with paper and packaging papers prices continuing to be depressed, particularly in Europe. And then the other kind of standout loser, for lack of a better term, has probably been AB InBev. So if you think you rewind the clock to kind of 2016, when AB InBev acquired SAB Miller and then listed on the JSE, it's been kind of one-way traffic since, with the share prices just persistently underperformed the JSE. But funnily enough, we think everything has a price. So we think now the kind of that level of despondency and negative sentiment is more than reflected in some of those multinational prices. So we actually are buying the likes of Mondi and SAB or AB InBev.
Rory, speaking of the sentiment, how does the sentiment look now, January 2025 versus January 2024? I know when I started looking at the markets, we were back in studio quite early in the year, and I thought we'd have a strong start to January. The first week of January was absolutely manic. We were down about 2% on the top 40. The second week hasn't started off too well in terms of full trading weeks. But how is the sentiment now versus this time last year?
I mean, so I think sentiment now versus this time last year is still significantly better. But I think sentiment probably peaked around September, October, and we saw some weakness in December. And then we've seen continued heightened levels of kind of uncertainty and weakness in the first 2 weeks. And it continues to be extremely volatile. So it almost feels like every time there's a new data point out of the US, depending on how the market interprets it positively or negatively, you can see 2, 3, 4% movements. Both offshore and domestically. But if I just focus on the JSE, so kind of what's our lay of the land? I mean, I must highlight that we're far from kind of macro political specialists. We focus very much on bottom-up fundamental analysis. And when we look at the basket of equities available, we think in particular now a handful of the SAN companies that looked very cheap last year are now pricing in quite rosy expectations over the next 3 or 4 years within SA. And we think that's far from a certain outcome. And so we've been actively kind of reducing our SA Inc. exposure and at the margin increasing exposure to the underperformers from last year, the likes of Mondi and AB InBev, as I mentioned.
Rory, speaking of the exposure side of things, what are some of the risks you're seeing going into 2025? Obviously, there's a lot that's still up in the air. There's a lot that's been settled with the elections of 2024. But what are some of the risks that have you concerned on from a portfolio level? And how is that affecting kind of how you're looking at your investment strategy for this year?
So I guess if I put it into kind of two buckets, so globally, the big risk we're worried about is really kind of this polarization geopolitically, where you've seen kind of the West and the East divide. But then even within countries, if you look at a number of the developed markets, there's a polarization of politics where the moderate middle seems to have completely disappeared. And so that's kind of the big risk we were worried about in terms of how populist policies may play out and how those may impact the way various economies and countries work with each other. And so Africa is very much kind of torn in, or stuck in the middle, in the sense that we're still very reliant on the US for a number of our agricultural commodities and exports, but we're equally as reliant on China for hard commodity exports. And then domestically, I mean, the big risks are really the kind of the risks we've worried about in SA for some time, and I don't think they've gone away. So temporarily, you know, load shedding has gone away, and it looks like Eskom has fixed a lot of the issues. But, you know, if I think over the last kind of 16 years, we've had multiple periods where we had load shedding, and then it disappeared for 2-3 years, only to reemerge a couple of years later. So the first one we're worried about is the ongoing kind of performance of our parastatals. And we have seen some kind of positive lights there, but there's still a lot of water to flow. And then I think the other big issues we're worried about from a South African perspective is, you know, we continue to run a primary deficit. Our debt to GDP is growing quite rapidly. When last I looked, it was around 75%. You know, at current interest rates, just north of 20% of total government revenue is going to be spent on just servicing the debt. It's not even repaying the debt or utilizing those funds to kind of invest in the economy. We've still got chronic unemployment, and I don't think our regulatory policies are very conducive to creating jobs and growing jobs. I know the education stats came out yesterday and people were excited about them. I still think the number of kids that fail to get to matric in Africa is a massive concern. And late last year, there was a study that came out that compared grade 5 South Africans with grade 4s from a number of other countries, and we scored basically last. So education remains a major concern. And then if you look at what's happened at a number of the municipalities, you know, there's ongoing municipal failure. So I think these are the structural issues Africa is faced with, not to say they're all insurmountable, but I think you have to think about those when you're looking at what's priced into the equities in SA. And so if I compare 2025 with 2024, I think at the start of 2024, a lot of those risks were more than priced into the domestic names, whereas today, there's a significant amount of improvement in some of those risks priced in, and it's not obvious to us that those things suddenly dramatically get better. We have yet to see the GNU be properly tested.
There's lots to consider when looking at your 2025 strategy and your plans, but most importantly, it's important to have a clear idea of how it is that you want to approach the year from an investing standpoint, especially if it is returns you are seeking. I think we'll leave the conversation there. Rory, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Rory Kutiska-Jacobson, Portfolio Manager at Allan Gray. The segment was brought to you by Allan Gray. More than 50 years of long-term investing. Allan Gray is an authorized financial services provider.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's Wednesday. It's executive lounge time on a Wednesday, and we're chatting to a very special executive about a very special journey leading one of the largest companies that we have on the JSE. I'm joined on the line by the outgoing CEO or retiring CEO at Astral Foods, a gentleman by the name of Christian Schutte. He's been at the business since 2005, officially being the CEO since 2009, so more than 16 years as the CEO of Astral Foods. That time has come to an end. At the end of this month, Chris will be stepping down. But before he steps down, he's graciously agreed to chat to us about his career and about the things that he's enjoyed most. Christian, good evening. Thanks so much for taking the time. 16 years as the CEO, more than 20 years at the company. It's been quite the journey. How do you reflect on it?
Jimmy, good day. Yeah, thank you for that question. Just to give a bit of perspective, I started in the poultry industry in 1984. So it's 41 years this year as a poultryman. Started right at the bottom in a poultry shed and moved along in the company. And when Astral was formed out of the Tiger group. It was unbundled. All the primary agricultural companies was unbundled out of Tiger Brands. And I moved to that part of the business and first involved in the feed side of the business, and then later on joined the board in 2006, the main board, and was appointed the CEO against any expectation in 2009. And here I am 16 years later with the privilege of leading this great company, CEO for the past 16 years. I'm being told that it's one of the longest serving CEOs on the JSE. So, yeah, what an exciting journey. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Chris, what keeps a man a poultry man for four decades?
That's a difficult question to answer. I always get asked, how did you join the poultry industry? It was purely by default. I was in the early years of my life, just after school, enrolled in the Air Force. And after the four-year contract, I was looking for a job and was offered this junior job as a shed worker on a poultry farm. And that's where it started. So I'm not sure if I chose the poultry industry or if it chose me. So it's a very exciting business. It's alive. Every day you wake up and the environment around you is different. And you have to adapt to that. And it keeps you awake and it keeps you on your toes every day.
Certainly things like bird flu definitely keep you up at night, especially when you think about a business the size of Astral and the impact that that would have on that business. But we're not talking about Astral tonight. We are taking a look at the life and the career that was the career of Mr. Christian Skytte. Chris, what would you say was the biggest thing that you've learned in your career? I mean, it's been quite a lengthy career. It has been an extensive career with lots of experience across various aspects of the business, across various businesses, as you mentioned. What would you say were some of the key things that you've learned in your career?
Yeah, the first thing, and just to give a bit perspective, so I'm also apparently one of the only CEOs with no university degree or further education beyond Standard 10. So I had to wake up earlier in the morning and go to bed later. And later on in my career, there was only one thing that was important, and that's to surround yourself with the best people you can find. And I think that's been a great part of the success of Astral is the team effort. So the one thing is you cannot do it all on your own. Make sure you've got a strong team, people that pull in the same direction, who share the same vision. And I would reckon that any business, you know, especially in the listed arena, it's about a team and the people and not anything different from that.
Going into retirement at the end of this month, what are you most looking forward to about hanging up your hat and taking a bit of a breather?
Yeah, so everybody's got this dream about traveling and reading and playing golf and sitting on the beach. At this point in time, I don't really know what's going to happen to me. We've made a decision to go back to our roots down in the Southern Cape, where I met my wife in 1978. We got married in George, and we made a conscious decision to move down there and almost start anew down in the Southern Cape. Great place. I grew up in the Karoo and Oudtshoorn. And I think we're going to take it very slow for a year. But in that year, I'm still involved in Astral from a oversight position. So I think my first year will only start in 2026, where I really don't have any connection to Astral anymore. However, I have a lot of interest in Astral. I am quite a sizable shareholder in the business, so I don't think I can ever box it away and put it away. So and the poultry industry will always have new challenges. And then I think in a year or two from now, we'll make a decision how we're going to conduct this last phase of our lives. But no plans. I want to make sure that I put this career, you know, box it away nicely so that I can hand over to a great team. And then I would like to see how they're going to perform. There's some great people that worked with me for many, many years, some of them 40 years. The incoming CEO has been with me for 28 years. So I'm looking forward to see how they take this business to a next level.
After 47 years together, what would Mrs. Skitter say about you deciding to leave at this point, and what would she be most relieved about?
I think she's extremely nervous. I was born a disciplinarian, so everything in my life is very clear. It's all square and leveled out. Wherever I go, I square up everything on my desk, in the poultry shed, in my garage, in the fridge. Everything is square. And if I'm going to spend more time at home, she's going to be very afraid of me trying to run our lives in the way that I was brought up. So I think she's very, very nervous about me hanging around the house. And we're going to have to manage that. But we never, over the past 40 years, involved in poultry. It's a 24/7 game and all around the clock all year. So we never had extended holidays or travel arrangements or fancy vacations. So I think typically we're going to try and in the first year is just do a bit of traveling. And that traveling will be local. We've got a beautiful country and there's so many things we haven't explored. So it will give us a bit of freedom to wake up one morning and say, let's leave tomorrow to a small town somewhere in the Karoo or in the West Coast. So I think we're both looking forward to just a bit of more freedom around traveling arrangements.
Chris, is there a hobby that you're looking forward to taking up that you might not have had time to while you were working? Is there something you've always wanted to just try that you never had the time to pursue?
Look, I've always been a keen golfer but never played. So my handicap is golf. So we live on a golf estate now. I play maybe once every second month, and now we're moving to a golfing estate down in the Southern Cape. So I'm going to try to become better at golf. I love the game because you play against yourself and you're handicapped by yourself. And I love that kind of challenge. So I'm looking forward to that. And then also we've been avid Harley Davidson people. So we've spent more than 50,000 kilometers together on a Harley Davidson, and now we'll have time, especially with the good roads down in the southern Western Cape, is maybe just to get back on the Harley again. It's been parked now for over 5 years, so we're going to take that up again, Jimmy.
When you're on the Harley and you're seeing the countryside and you're traveling through South Africa, what's the one thing that you want to stop for? What's the one meal that you stop for and you think, I can't go without this?
Well, it's interesting. It's not actually a meal. What I like about it is to stop with a Harley at a fuel station or petrol station or at a toll gate or at a Wimpy and then meet the people. And I'm notorious for appointing people that's got the spark in their eye. And I've got a number of people over the past couple of years that I picked up either as petrol attendants or waiters or people working at toll gates. So that's the one thing I look forward is to look for that one person that just needs a bit of an opportunity somewhere. And I've got, I believe it's over 90 of those kind of people that I've met over the past years that still actively work in our group. So that's the one thing I like is to find that one person who needs a bit of a kickstart.
Always giving back despite being on holiday. Chris, if you had to impart one piece of wisdom that you've carried with you throughout your entire career, perhaps to someone that is starting out at Astral, or even to someone that is just looking at starting a business, starting something new, what would that be?
The one thing is surround yourself with good people, but life in general is a DIY job. You can't expect anybody else but yourself to shape your life or your career. You have to do everything yourself. It's a DIY job. And you can do that only if you surround yourself with good people who's got the same vision. So wake up a bit earlier. And one lesson, I still make my own bed every day or almost every day. So that is how you start. It's a discipline. If you don't have discipline, you're going to struggle in any form of business. Self-discipline. Clean your own shoes, make your own bed, always be on time, and have respect for the people around you.
Mm-hmm. What about striking a balance between work and home life and not being someone that overworks? How do you approach that? How would you say that those out there that are perhaps struggling with that can look at it. I mean, to have a sustainable career for so long at some point requires some element of balance.
Yeah, and I'm guilty of that. I don't have a good balance, and I haven't had up to a year or two ago. From the point that I realized that it's time to move on, there were no balance, and that's not healthy. But then again, you know, if you put together in some not in a, in the standard way, is you work hard and you don't see it as a challenge, but it's continuous improvement, and it doesn't matter how many hours it take, but you're never done with your work. So
work hard and find the right people to work with. We're going to have to leave the conversation there. Chris, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. That was Christian Schutte, who is the retiring CEO of Astral Foods, joining us for this week's Executive Lounge. It's gone 7 o'clock. Greg Coase is standing by with the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. From my side, good night.